Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
It would be hard to overestimate the hold Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow had on the American psyche at the crest of their crime wave. As they robbed and murdered civilians and law enforcement officers across multiple states, people knew enough to be afraid of meeting them in person. But for a brief moment, their rampage and their love affair was the most perversely glamorous story in the headlines, and it all began in North Texas. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. A new American Experience documentary recounts their lives together in great detail and explains how they were finally caught in a hail of gunfire when they least expected it. Filmmaker John Maggio directed Bonnie and Clyde, which airs tonight at 8 o'clock on KERA-TV. John, welcome back to Think.
Thanks a lot for having me, Chris.
Why are Bonnie and Clyde still household names more than 80 years after they were killed?
You know, it's. I think most of it has to do with the 67 Arthur Penn movie. It was such, you know, like many sort of legends, you could say the same of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kids. That was, you know, the golden age of Hollywood. And he made a fabulous film. And Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway were beautiful. It was stylish. It projected an image of people who were thumbing their nose at authority, which was what the 60s were all about. So it just happened to be that good that it kind of stuck with us. You know, I don't think a lot of people were thinking about them by 67, especially because, you know, we had the 67 is the end of some of the production codes in Hollywood that would have limited the kind of glorification of gangsters the way Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde did. So I think in large part that's one of the reasons it's still with us.
You born somewhere around East Texas, right?
Yeah.
You come from a big old family?
Yeah.
You went to school, of course, but you didn't take to it much because you was a lot smarter than everybody else, so you just up and quit one day. Now, when you were 17, there was a guy who worked in a
cement plant.
Right, cement plant. And you liked him because he thought you were just as nice as you could be. And you almost married that guy. But then you thought, no, you didn't think you would. So then you got your job in a cafe. And now you wake up every morning, you hate it. You just hate it. You get on down there and you put on your white uniform.
Pink. It's pink.
Uh-huh. And them truck drivers come in there to eat your greasy burgers and they kid you and you kid them back. But they're stupid and dumb boys with the big old tattoos on them and you don't like it. So you go on home and you sit in your room and you think, now when and how am I ever going to get away from this? And now you know.
That, of course, is the fictionalized film. We're speaking to the director of the documentary, Bonnie and Clyde. They took some licenses with the facts there. In fact, Bonnie Parker was married before she met Clyde.
That's right. She married very young. She dropped out of school and married a guy named Roy Thornton. Who was her sweetheart, and she got a tattoo of Roy's name on the inside of her thigh, which is a pretty daring thing to do for a young lady back then. They do take license. That's why it's such a beautiful film and portrayal of two people. I can't sort of raise my film to the level of that, but what we can do is take some of the great footage and photos that are extant and really sort of look in and try to make three-dimensional characters, real characters out of these people.
So Clyde Barrow was born into this big farm family, but they packed up and moved to Dallas when he was a kid. Where did they settle and how did they make a living in the city?
Well, they settled in West Dallas, what was then known as the Devil's Back Porch, which is just an amazing.
It's a great neighborhood name if you don't live there.
Yeah, exactly. But they did odd jobs. They eventually opened a service station later on when Clyde was a little bit older, but they didn't do much. It was very difficult. The poverty there was just unbelievable, and I think that when we think about Clyde and Bonnie, who lived in Cement City, not far from the slums of West Dallas, they could both look at Dallas proper. They could look at downtown Dallas and see the lights and sort of dream and try to imagine what a life could be like if they could just get there. And I think Clyde obviously decided to take a shortcut to try to get to that life.
It's interesting to think about them both really dreaming of better, and none of that would excuse, you know, their descent into really violent crime, but they both had this sense that they had almost been born into the wrong lives.
I think that's right. I think that's right. Clyde seems to me to be the kind of guy who was a dreamer from the beginning. And, you know, for a lot of people in the Depression era, you know, they try to take a shortcut. Let me rephrase that. I don't think a lot of people did, but some people did. And I think Bonnie is of the same ilk. She was good at school. She was very into poetry. She wanted to be an actress. She sang. She danced. She was, you know, if she were alive today, maybe she would have gone to Hollywood and sought fame or come to New York and try to find fame on Broadway. But that wasn't in the cards for her. But, yeah, they both were dreamers.
Bonnie seems to be this sort of person who maybe had some potential, but, you know, also had this knack for picking exactly the wrong men.
Yeah. Isn't that the story? I mean, that's that we see these people throughout history, right? I mean, she did, you know, she went against, you know, her mother, Emma, raised her and her brother and sister by herself. Her father had died when Bonnie was just very young. And I think invested a lot in the children and had hoped a lot for Bonnie. And she did seem to show a lot of promise. And Emma was very distraught when Bonnie left high school and married Roy, for sure, who, you know, Roy Thornton, by all accounts, was himself a small-time criminal. He beat her, and he would go just leave. And eventually he did finally just leave her. But, you know, there is an attraction there, I guess. There's a sex appeal to the bad boy, and she certainly was attracted to that. And shortly after Roy left, she met Clyde.
The first bad boy in the Barrow family was actually not Clyde. It was his older brother, Buck, who had a knack for hot wiring cars and was happy to teach baby brother how to do it, too.
That's right. Buck is an interesting character. Also very good looking. I think both he and Clyde. Clyde is tough, too. You know, when you look at these photos, Clyde looks different in every photo. He's got this kind of baby face look sometimes, but then as he got older, he looks a little bit more worn out and more adult, but still very difficult to pin. But Buck had this sort of outward physical charisma that I see. He's tall. He's always dressed in good suits. And he, I think, also shared Clyde's longing to get out of West Dallas and again took a shortcut. They would start stealing chickens, and then he got, as you say, got very good at stealing cars and passed it along to Clyde. He wasn't as good as Clyde, unfortunately, for him in getting away. Clyde always seemed to be able to slip away, and Buck, for a large part of this story, is in prison.
But Clyde is often ready to go bust him out.
Yes, he's chomping at the bit. And, you know, there's a lot of, it's interesting because, you know, when we look at this kind of 2 year or so crime spree that he and Bonnie went on, and you try to sort of figure out, well, what were the motives? A lot of people believe it was to get back at the jail system that had held his brother and that had held a lot of his friends, and that he was just always sort of seeking revenge, which has always been hard for me to really wrap my brain around. He did have a horrible time in prison. He did want his brother to be free, but it's hard for me to pin all those lives on that single motivation.
Do you have the sense that Clyde Barrow looked at crime as his career?
I think not initially, but I think that after a while you realize, well, what am I good at? I'm not good at holding down a steady job. I'm really good at stealing cars. I'm really good at driving fast. It seems to be pretty easy to get away because I can cross state lines and I don't have to worry about federal crime yet. And so the second I get across the state line, those officers are not going to chase me. I think he realized that he was good at it, and it was a way for him to get the things that he wanted, at least initially. I mean, you know, when you talk to the family, they say, well, he just wanted to be free. But I guess that crime is, as I say, a shortcut to that kind of freedom.
You two talk to descendants of Bonnie and Clyde, or people who are related to them. They didn't have children together. But, I mean, what do you do with a legacy like that in your family history? Today, we sort of look at them and we're still struck by the romance of things. On the other hand, they were pretty cold-blooded killers.
Yeah, well, I think you change your last name. I think that some of them did that. Some of them embraced the Barrow name. But I think there, for some, there's some shame. There's a lot of sort of looking back, and you know, as they say in the film, they certainly don't condone what Bonnie and Clyde got into. I think, you know, there's maybe enough time that has passed now, and the, you know, you can attach yourself to the myth. But I think it was hard for them. I think it was real hard for them. And you see it. I think you'll see it in the film as they describe how their family dealt with it.
John Maggio is with us. He's a filmmaker who directed a new American Experience documentary called Bonnie and Clyde. You can see it tonight at 8 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with filmmaker John Maggio, who directed the new American Experience documentary Bonnie and Clyde. You can see it tonight at 8 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. We have an email here from John, who says there's no proof that Bonnie ever killed anyone. Clyde, yes, but not Bonnie. Is that the case as far as you understand, John?
Yes, that's what they say. I didn't see any. She was wrongfully sort of held out as being the shooter of a murder toward the end of their crime spree. But that was all made up.
Her first crime, though, was kind of a doozy. She smuggled a gun into a jail in Waco.
That's right. You know, it's incredible. You know, I'm always forced to, you know, it's so different from who I am, but you can't help but wonder about what would motivate her to do that other than just, you know, love and just a deep attraction and belief in this person that she felt for in Clyde. They really never left each other's side, which is, you know, you could look at that two ways. They are criminals, they're killers, or Clyde is a killer, but she did not leave his side, and she did that for him. That was she's dancing across the line right there, and it's an important part of their relationship.
How did they meet?
I believe it was just Clyde had come over to her house, was visiting there, and I think it was through mutual friends. As Boots Hinton in the film, who is the son of one of the people who tracked Bonnie and Clyde, recalls Bonnie's brother saying that it was just electric from the moment you could see the sparks fly from the second they met. At Bonnie's house.
All right, so we mentioned that she helped him bust out of jail in Waco, he and some cohorts. He was caught again. Clyde was caught again a week later, and this is kind of an important moment, it would seem, in his development, because when he was caught after that jailbreak, he was sent to a much tougher place.
He was, and you kind of do see it. I mean, I see this as the marking point. I think many people do, because, you know, yes, he was stealing cars that he was selling across state lines for a few bucks here and there, and it was great for him. And he made a little bit of money. He got some nicer suits. He was able to take his girlfriends out, including Bonnie out. But then when he gets sent to Eastham Prison Farm, he's sent into a whole other world of just really abject abuse by the prison guards, who would beat you for no reason other than the fact that you were there. They were forced into what was essentially slave labor out on the farms, working day and night. And to top it off, he was put in with some of the worst. To top it off, he was continually molested. By Big Ed Crowder, who was much bigger than him. Clyde was a very diminutive guy. And that's where Clyde really is transformed at that prison from a schoolboy to a rattlesnake, as one of the other inmates said of Clyde. But he gets his revenge. He ends up killing Crowder. He gets off somehow. And just when you think, okay, here it is, this is the moment, the killing, he goes one step further, because the killing wasn't going to keep him, that kept him safe at least for now, but he's still going to have to go out into these fields. And to keep himself from that, he chopped off one of his own toes. I mean, that's how bad the situation was. And this apparently was not uncommon in that prison. So it gives you a sense of how desperate this young man is, and how you can imagine how it would change you.
Amazingly, someone else in Eastern Prison Farm was willing to take the fall for Clyde, somebody who knew he was never getting out anyway.
Yeah, it was a man named Aubrey Scally, who had a beef with Ed Crowder as well. And as the story has been told, Clyde basically ambushed Ed Crowder in the latrine with a lead pipe and cracked him over the head with it. And then Scally jumped in and stabbed him a number of times. But the autopsy report that we saw from the prison says that Crowder died of a blunt force trauma to the head. So it was really Clyde's blow that killed him, but Scally was a lifer already. He felt he had nothing else to live for, and he just wanted to get revenge.
So Clyde cut off his own toe so that he wouldn't have to work in the fields, but I guess unbeknownst to him, during this time, his mom was working to get him released. Like, it turned out not to have been necessary.
Yes. It's just like, just an incredible irony, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the pardons were not that uncommon at that time. It was just to ease overcrowding in the prison system. So I remember when I heard that, I thought, well, that seems like a kind of far-fetched, but it was true. And Clyde certainly had very loyal allies in his mother and father and his family in general. And so she worked to get her son out. And just months after he had taken off his own toe, which kept him in the hospital, kept him out of the prison farm, on the farm part of it for a little while, he's released. And he's changed. I mean, not only does he have a limp for the rest of his life, but he really is a changed person. It seems like there's not a whole lot to live for after that point.
So people who knew him noticed that his demeanor was different.
Yeah, and he also, he vowed never to go back to prison again. I mean, that was, everyone said that. Everyone in the family said that. He said, there's no way he's going back to that hellhole, is what he said. And, he did, I believe, try to take a normal job. It just didn't take. And, I think to your point earlier, he was just good at crime. I think he just settled it on that. He was able to steal these very fast 1932 Ford V8s that happened to come out right as he was coming out of prison. And boy, that really set him off.
I thought it was funny that the Barrow gang prided themselves on only stealing the best cars. Like, they wouldn't take some old clunker.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's funny because, a lot of the police forces at the time, many of them were voluntary. Many of them had to come with their own car, so they were driving old beat-up trucks and jalopies. And Clyde would take these Ford V8s so he can get going 80 miles an hour in backcountry roads. And, after a couple curves, there was no catching him. This wasn't – a lot of the stuff that was happening out there in the country, they were out – driven by Clyde.
So Bonnie and Clyde and their associates pull off a robbery. Bonnie ends up going to jail, and by the time she comes out, she too, maybe purposely rather than based on things that she'd experienced, she's created this new persona for herself by the time she emerges.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I mean, the poem that we quote from, that we read from, is called Suicide Sal. And it's a story about a woman whose man has done her wrong. Clyde got away from that. They were trying to rob a car, and Clyde and his partner got away, but Bonnie got picked up. And she claimed that she had been kidnapped or whatever. And anyways, the jury let her go. But while the time that she was in the holding cell there for I'm not exactly sure how long, while they waited for the grand jury to come back, she wrote this poem, Suicide Sal, and it's all about this jilted lover and how she would never be that way, and she's going to stand by her man's side. And she's using all the language of a gangster, of the kind of women that she may have been seen at the picture shows that she was really fond of. And it's really like, as her mother says at that time, she began to see a very terrifying change in her daughter. She was becoming this gangster on her own. Whether or not she committed any killings, she wanted to live that life, and she wanted to live it by Clyde's side.
How did Bonnie and Clyde become more than just a local nuisance to the places where they were targeting them, their crimes?
Yeah. You know, their crimes were adding up, and they were killing, you know, as I've said before, you know, they weren't, a lot of the sort of Depression era criminals that were seemed to come out of nowhere during that time, like Dillinger and Babyface Nelson and others, they were committing big crimes against the establishment in a way, robbing banks for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. And it was easy to see them as a almost like a Robin Hood kind of thing. But Bonnie and Clyde were not doing that. The Barrow Gang was not doing that. It was lots of petty crimes, mom and pop stores, tons of car theft, and unfortunately killing people who got in their way of those things, of their freedom, of their ability to be on the road. So it started to add up. They were sort of local stories. But it's not until 1933, after Buck, his brother, incidentally, joins him in Joplin, Missouri, and they have to flee a hideout, and they leave a bunch of their stuff behind, including some undeveloped film. And the police develop that film, and it's really at that moment. It's the moment when they cross over from just being, you know, a local story to a national story, because those photographs of them, which I consider kind of the original selfies in a way, get broadcast around the nation. And they're suddenly larger than life. There are newsreels that play, that follow their moves. People start tuning in and start wondering about who these characters are, this sort of like dark prince and princess of the underworld.
The most iconic photo of Bonnie Parker on her own, where she's got one leg hitched up on the bumper of this car and she's, you know, toting a gun and she's got a cigar in her mouth. That's the photo people think of, and yet Bonnie hated that picture.
She really did, which is so funny, isn't it? I mean, when you think about they're just a couple of kids on the side of the road goofing around, taking photos of themselves. And she was really annoyed because she didn't smoke cigars, and she didn't want to be known as somebody, as a woman who smokes cigars, and it drove her nuts. And she tried to correct the record, actually, while they were on the road. She wanted to make sure that, you know, if they instead of killing a deputy, they kidnapped him, she would tell that deputy to let them know she doesn't smoke cigars. It speaks to a kind of vanity. It speaks to a kind of narcissism in a person who's trying to control her image and control their story. I mean, her poetry is about that too. She's essentially writing the Bonnie and Clyde story in her poetry. So she wants to be in control of her own image.
We're speaking this hour with filmmaker John Maggio, who directed the new American Experience documentary Bonnie and Clyde, which airs tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13. We'll be back in 2 minutes with director John Maggio.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with director John Maggio about the new American Experience documentary Bonnie and Clyde. You can see it tonight at 8 o'clock on KERA TV Channel 13. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. John, it's remarkable to think about this, but when Bonnie and Clyde and the gang needed weapons, they made this practice of stopping by National Guard armories and robbing them for whatever they needed.
Yeah, it's incredible the arsenal they had. I mean, you know, Clyde prided himself on having these Browning automatic rifles with him, which are just, you know, today they're just... yeah, they're incredibly powerful machine guns, and he had armor-piercing bullets. And, you know, that whole idea of them robbing these armories does lend some credence to the idea that they were amassing this arsenal for a big, you know, prison break or a big to get their revenge. And, you know, it takes them maybe 2 years to get there, but it is remarkable. You know, whenever they were in Joplin in 33, and then later on at the end when they were killed, they had like 10 shotguns on them. incredible amounts of ammunition. So these cars they were stealing, they were constantly having to transport all this weaponry. It's dark. It's very dark. And that's sort of what's at the center of this film is a kind of darkness. There's a playfulness to their story, the way we retell the myth of the sort of Romeo and Juliet and the romance. But there's such darkness at its core as well.
Did they fight?
Probably. I mean, I think that Bonnie was no shrinking violet. She was a tough girl. She was opinionated. I can't imagine they didn't fight. Again, we're not privy to their private thoughts. Her journaling is sort of stops, and it's really in her poetry. And if we look at a poem like Suicide Sail, there at the heart of that poem is a sort of lover's quarrel about being true to each other. So I have to imagine with the intensity of their endeavor and their getaways and the intensity of their romance, I'm sure they fought.
They were nearly done in before the end by, of all things, a car accident.
Yes. Tragic. I mean, tragic in the sense that Bonnie, again, is the one who is severely injured. It's unclear. Some people say that it was the car exploded after they drove off the road into like a dry riverbed. Others, and that's what caused the fire, which burnt her leg, by some accounts, down to the bone. Mm. Others say it was leaking battery acid. Hard to know. She could barely walk. She's a cripple after that point. And Clyde literally has to carry her from place to place, and yet still doesn't drop her off at home. They're still sneaking back home. When we talk about the romance and the mythology of these two, this was not a glamorous lifestyle they were living. Certainly after the Wellington, Texas accident, that was not. They were bathing in creeks. Clyde was sneaking in trying to find medicine and salve to cover her burns. They were eating out of tin cans. I mean, there was nothing after that point. Everything was very unromantic.
How did it happen they kept, stopping somewhere in or around Dallas to meet up with friends and family? How is it that they weren't caught here? It would seem like that would be the place where Hoover would have sent people to kind of keep an eye out for them.
Yeah, it's interesting. There were, after FDR is elected and Hoover starts the Bureau of Federal Investigation, he does have agents in Dallas working the case. But he's not nearly as interested in Bonnie and Clyde as he is in John Dillinger. Hmm. So it's really just sort of a local nuisance for the feds as part of this story. But it also speaks to, their ability to be secretive and the family kind of supporting that. Legend has it, and we cover this in the film, is that they would drive through on the outskirts of town or drive past and throw a Coke bottle out with a message inside, and then the family would make a series of phone calls to other parts of the family with some kind of code where they would say, we're going to have red beans and rice tonight, which was code for meet out at the picnic ground. And so they were able to sort of piece it together in some incredible way. I mean, after a while, I believe the police started tapping Cumie Barrow, Clyde's mother's phone, and Emma as well. And so I think it became, the noose was tightening, but for a long time there, even very close to the end, they were able to still meet with them, which is quite remarkable. It's funny because you also do get a sense of a kind of hominess within Dallas. Like, they were locals, and as desperate and awful as they were, I often wonder if there wasn't, some kind of collusion going on. I don't understand it, to be honest.
They were finally brought down in what amounted to a betrayal.
That's right, which is a part of the story I'd never heard of. And they were betrayed by a gentleman named Henry Methvin, which Methvin, that name is just not very cinematic. I wish he had a different name. It was a guy who Clyde had helped bust out of Easton Prison there toward the end, whose parents had made a deal with the Louisiana and the Texas Texas authorities, and they had this legendary guy now, Frank Hamer, sort of chasing them, who was like the greatest Texas Ranger ever to live. And the noose really started tightening, and Henry Methvin really was their undoing. I mean, his parents really set the trap for Bonnie and Clyde in Louisiana.
Did Henry Methvin know anything about what was about to take place?
You know, there's lots of debate about that. And there's two camps that believe, yes, he was very aware of it, and he drew them in, and there's another camp that says he wasn't. He says he wasn't, and that it was his parents doing. So the jury is still out. Again, you know, one of the issues in, you know, I've made a number of different films on gangsters is they don't leave motive anywhere. They don't leave journals explaining their motivation. So it's hard to know.
How many bullets were in their car when it was found?
They say over 150. I mean, if you see the car, it's hard not to believe that. I mean, there are bullet holes you don't see. But they were armed. This posse that ambushed Bonnie and Clyde were armed with BARs and armor-piercing bullets. There was no way they were going to let him get away. He'd gotten away so many times. There was no question that this was going to be a execution. And they really just, you know, they don't even really stop to, there were some who debated whether or not that Bonnie should be part of that, you know. There were some who knew she hadn't been involved in any of the killings. But they didn't, they decided in the end to go for it. And there's also a lot of people who claim that, you know, that maybe trumping up one of the last crimes that were committed with Henry Methvin was trumped up because they'd already made a deal with Henry Methvin, so Bonnie was forced to take the blame. I don't know, but it's all there in the film to ponder.
They wanted to be buried, if one is to believe Bonnie's poem, side by side. Why did that not happen?
Well, Bonnie's mother just felt like, you know, and she says in its own sort of poetry that Clyde had her in life and he couldn't have her in death. I think it speaks to Emma's shame and horror and disappointment in Bonnie and the whole experience. I mean, you see it, you know, you can really see it on her face. She ages so much. Emma looks so old by the time this whole thing, the whole family does. They just look beaten down. And I think it was just an act of defiance. She wasn't going to let it happen that way.
Do you have a favorite image of them? I'm sure you've come through so many archival materials at this point. Is there one that just really sticks with you?
You know, it's the one where you can't see either of their faces, but they're sort of entangled in almost like the artist Klimt. You know, that
the kiss.
The kiss. And it's from behind, and they're clearly on the side of the road, and they do look like matinee idols. And there's something about not seeing their eyes which allows me to put them in that space. You know, when you see somebody's eyes, when you look into Clyde's eyes and you look into Bonnie's eyes, you're forced to deal with their humanity, which for a lot of people is difficult. But when you don't see them that way, when you see them more as the sort of, as the myth, and this really, I have to say, whoever was taking the photos did have an eye for composition. You'll see it in the film, but that to me is always just sort of stuck in my head, is these young lovers who just were hell bent for leather.
John Maggio directed the American Experience documentary Bonnie and Clyde. You can watch it tonight at 8 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 Television. John, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us today.
Thank you so much, Chris.